All right, so I just want to, well, I'm sold now. I got to put on my reading glasses just to read my own notes. Damn, it turned out to be an interesting time to have accepted a while back. I don't know when we set it up, Bob, a talk here at the OEL. I don't know if it's my 11th or 12th or whatever. And, you know, I was going to do my standard kind of report from Iowa on the state of the miserable state of American electoral politics. And lo and behold, history interceded and rebellion intervened. You know, I've been so good at predicting horrible things that have happened in American history, or sort of outlining how things aren't going to go the way some progressives think they're going to. But I'm always amazed at how unpredictable and surprising things like Occupy, you know, and things like the May Day rallies in 06, those unpredictable, it really gives me hope that this stuff, that this this kind of inspiring thing can emerge any time, any day, with the right instigation. You know, I had no idea when I agreed to this date that my old nemesis, Rahm Emanuel, was going to be in such hot water, and that so many young black activists and citizens were going to be in motion, calling, among other things, for Tiny Dancer's resignation. I'll get back to why I call him Tiny Dancer in a second. But I do want to emphasize among other things, because I'm hearing a lot more than just calling for, you know, Alvarez to go from state's attorney or Rahm to go from city hall. There's a lot of good talk, necessary talk about institutional and structural change beneath and beyond personnel changes in top officers, in top offices in the cities. You know, some of you may know that one of Rahm's earliest nicknames was Tiny Dancer. He got that because of his short stature and because he was once a very talented ballet student, talented enough to be invited to train for the Joffrey Ballet. And, you know, I want to see I prefer Rambo, actually. I want to see Rambo out of City Hall. I'm glad McCarthy is out as police chief. I'm glad other top-ranking CPD officials have had to leave. I think Anita Alvarez absolutely needs to exit the state's attorney's office. I mean, the behavior of Emanuel and Alvarez and other so-called truly other so-called city leaders in the Laquan McDonald murder case, I mean, it's unreal. It's just disgraceful. It's just shameful. The revelations just get worse and worse and worse. There's this sort of rolling snowball aspect to this scandal. So we've got the city keeping the tape of the killing under wraps for more than a year because Rambo feared releasing it would hurt his chances of winning black votes that he needed for re-election. Votes he was worried about, of course, after 4 years of closing down black schools to make his wealthy charter school buddies happy, and after years of stonewalling on racist police abuse regarding issues like the Rekia Boyd murder and the Homan Square Black Site Detention Center out on the west side. There's some reasons he's worried about that black vote. We've got the city refusing to release another police murder tape, the Ronald Johnson video, over pretty much the same exact period of time. We've got Rambo / Tiny Dancer preposterously claiming, I mean, who could possibly believe this, that he had never seen the Laquan murder tape prior to its release. We've got Officer Jason Van Dyke being allowed to the killer, being allowed to stay on the force, full pay, 13 months, after conducting what was a blatant extrajudicial execution, clearly visible on tape. I mean, when a white cop was seen on video fatally shooting a fleeing black suspect in Charleston, South Carolina earlier this year, he was charged in just 5 days. We've got Rambo's longstanding heroes, the Chicago police, threatening the Laquan killings eyewitnesses with arrest and deleting more than an hour of videotape from an adjacent fast food restaurant near the murder site. We've got Emanuel claiming that he didn't want to release the Laquan video because he feared it might taint a federal investigation, even while the U.S. Justice Department says that it never once asked the city to hold off on releasing the tape. We've got the recent revelation that the city's so-called independent police review authority has received no less than 10,000 excessive force complaints since 2008, which have resulted in the dismissal of just 4 officers. The IPRA's, the IPRA's previous chief, Lorenzo Davis, fired by the city earlier this year because he refused to reverse his finding that a fatal police shooting was unjustified. You know, one that's really stuck with me is where Emanuel met with Chicago's leading black ministers before the he finally released the Laquan video, which was a couple weeks ago. You know, the ostensible purpose of this meeting was to assuage black fears and black anger about how City Hall was dealing with the case. But when speaking to the ministers, Tiny Dancer had a different kind of message. Basically, he warned them that they'd pay if protests went too far. Basically, he said, you know, I don't want to see too much unrest out there in the provinces, out there in the ghettoized colonies of the South and West Side, or he would withhold money for jobs programs run through the churches. I mean, talk about the misplaced arrogance of power. I mean, it takes some serious sociopathic chutzpah. I mean, it takes some real Joffrey Ballet cojones to, you know, bully normally obedient black pastors like that after you've just been caught with your racist police state pants down around your ankles and the whole world watching, if I might resurrect a phrase from 1968. You know, so for all these and other reasons, I would applaud if Tiny Dancer had to pirouette off of City Hall Central Stage. None of his behavior, by the way, is remotely surprising to any of us who have followed his career from the left. If any of you haven't read it yet, I do highly recommend journalist Kari, I'm going to mispronounce her name, Carrie Leiderson's biography, Mayor 1%. You know, if you read that book, you'll see really from the flowering of his national political career, which was with the Bill Clinton campaign and presidency in the 90s, through his years as a congressman, you know, where, by the way, he was in charge of marginalizing all the Democratic congressional candidates who were against, who were openly against the Iraq War, through his years as a congressman and his years as Obama's chief of staff until today. And by the way, in that whole career trajectory, he's a couple of years out to make sure that he could make a shitload of money as a finance capitalist, which is part of why he has a net worth of $14 million right now. What's he got, a campaign finance war chest of $58 million or something? Anyway, through all that career, he's always been a notorious, almost Asperger syndrome-like bully of, you know, of epic proportions. He's always been a noxious, fake progressive Democratic Party epitome of what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called the triple evils that are interrelated. And for King, those triple evils were racism, economic injustice, also known as capitalism, and militarism. And I don't have time to go into all of Emanuel's career, but the intertwining of all of that and other evils are sort of just at the heart and the center of his whole trajectory of his public life. So yeah, I'd like to see the guy gone. At the same time, same for Alvarez and same for others, same for a lot of the black bourgeois misleaders of the black community in the South and the West Side who've been steering black votes towards before Emanuel, before Daley, and then for Emanuel, and really all the way going back to the original Daley's. A lot of the media talking heads out here. It's incredible. This is just like in the Holman Square thing and other scandals. It isn't even the real actual local journalists in the mainstream media that are they're doing the yeoman's work of exposing these kinds of things. Holman Square had to be exposed primarily by The Guardian under the pressure from sort of local insurgent rank-and-file journalists. And once again, here in this case, in the Laquan case, I think also there was somebody within the police department that may have tipped off some non-establishment journalists, right? I'd like to see some of those people lose their jobs over that, but don't hold your breath on that. At the same time, I want to issue a bit of a warning about over-focusing on specific elites and on the significance of symbolic personnel changes and reforms. You know, atop inherently oppressive and authoritarian institutions like the Chicago political machine, like the Chicago Police Department, and in fact, like the city and the nation's leading financial institutions and corporations, or for that matter, the American national military empire. Only by structural change can current evils be eliminated, Dr. King reminded us in 1967, because he said the roots ultimately are in the system rather than just in men or in faulty operations. The Black Revolution, King wrote near the end of his life, is forcing America to face all of its interrelated flaws, racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. It is exposing evils that are rooted deeply in the whole structure of society, King wrote. It reveals systemic rather than superficial flaws and suggests that the radical reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced, said King. The real issue to be faced beyond relatively superficial matters like the technical skin color or gender or even sometimes the partisan party identification of a presidential candidate. And here, I think King might have added evils that are rooted in the long and living history of American society and American institutions. As King noted near the end of his famous 1967 speech, in which he came out openly against the Vietnam War, quote, a nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years will thingify them. It will make them things. Therefore, that nation will exploit them and poor people generally, economically. And a nation that will exploit economically, King added, will have to have foreign investments in everything else and will have to use its military might to protect them. This, King said, again, to repeat myself, are the triple evils that are interwoven with one another, that are dialectically inseparable with each other. And this history angle, and particularly in connection with race, brings me to maybe somewhat belatedly to what my main topic is, which is, you know, how have Black lives mattered, past and present, to the U.S. capitalist economic system? And how does that history matter for Laquan McDonald, Ronald Johnson, Rekia Boyd, Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Terrence Shawn, and others sent to that vast burial ground of mostly young Black Americans who are killed by mostly white police officers on average once every 28 hours in this country? Simply astonishingly horrific. As the McDonald family said yesterday outside City Hall, there are thousands of Laquan McDonalds. And I want to go back and look at some of the history that brings us up to that savage and pathetic denouement, you know, a thousands of Laquan McDonalds, thousands of Mike Browns, thousands of Trayvon Martins, thousands of Rekia Boyds. You know, let's be honest about a really cold, brutal fact that lay behind the moral and economic case for me, which has always been slam dunk. I don't know how politically viable it is, but the moral and economic case for Black reparations in the U.S. Black lives have always mattered, first, fundamentally, and above all, to white capitalist America as a source of exploitation and as a source of profit. And white American authorities, from the British colonial North American phase up through the early Republic, up through the antebellum period, and up to this day, have never been particularly squeamish about killing and maiming Black Americans in defense and advance of that exploitation. Untold millions of Black slaves were systematically tortured, maimed, and murdered so that Southern tobacco, rice, sugar, and above all, cotton planters could extract vast quantities of surplus value, of profit from them, and profitable, capitalistically profitable, their slave system was. As the historian Edward Baptist has recently shown in his incredible award-winning book, The Half Has Never Been Told, the violence and torture that was systematically inflicted on Black Americans in the forced labor camps of the westward expanding U.S. cotton frontier in the first half of the 19th century generated the core and original economic surplus that underpinned the United States very emergence as a modern capitalist and industrial power. After reformist experiments under Union Army occupation during the Reconstruction era, 1866 to 1877, black cotton servitude was resurrected across what became known as the Jim Crow South. The last thing that black ex-slaves wanted to do after slavery was go back to work under white rule in southern cotton fields. But though the Civil War had ended slavery, the underlying economic functions that slavery had served ended up unchanged. A surrogate system of compulsory paid labor developed in its place. Ex-slaves were forced to struggle for survival as sharecroppers, tenant farmers, sometimes wage laborers in southern agriculture in, guess what, cotton. Once again, blacks paid the price, carried the burden for the nation's addiction to, need for, cheap and abundant cotton. Many thousands of black Americans died at the hands of white terrorist authorities, both private public, to keep black lives yoked to cotton, toiling for a pittance, or worse, under white owners during the long Jim Crow era. During and after World War I, through the 1960s, northern industrial firms' demand for cheap labor, and often for strike breakers, combined with the mechanization of southern cotton farming to push and to pull millions of blacks out of the South to work in giant steel mills, packing houses, auto assembly plants, and other mass production facilities, northern cities like Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Elizabethtown, New Jersey. By 1970, nearly half of the nation's black population for the first time lived north of the Mason-Dixon line. You know, and this great migration was a step forward toward freedom for many black Americans who escaped the open racial terror and the formal residential segregation and the formal segregation of services and political disenfranchisement in the South. But still, black lives mattered to northern white capitalists and authorities, mainly, again, and still, as a source of cheap, super exploited labor. Blacks were kept at the bottom of the northern industrial proletariat by their branded status as racial inferiors. Black workers were concentrated in northern industry's dirtiest, hottest, most unpleasant, worst paid, and least secure jobs. In Chicago's once giant, legendary slaughtering and meatpacking industry, Upton Sinclair's Jungle, which, by the way, by the 1940s was about 70% black, black employees' time cards were specially marked to make sure that they were the first fired and the last rehired during and after seasonal layoffs and economic downturns, and to make sure that they were assigned to the least desirable and most poorly paid jobs in most cases. They would have done that to the Latino workers in the stockyards, but they didn't have to because they could just look at it and say, this guy's name is Refugio Martinez. Whereas if your name was Henry Johnson, it was a possibility you were white, so you had to have your time card marked. The northern black population was penned up in inferior, overcrowded, ghetto neighborhood. Of course, they still are, but I mean was. Northern blacks, historian Thomas Sugrue notes, lived as second-class citizens, unencumbered, it's true, by the most blatant of Southern-style Jim Crow laws, but still nonetheless trapped in an economic, political, and legal regime that seldom recognized them as equals in nearly every arena. Blacks and whites in Chicago and Detroit and New York and Pittsburgh and the Twin Cities lived separate, unequal lives. This de facto racial separatism and disparity was sustained and enforced by violence. The agents of white northern repression, the enforcers of segregation and separatism and inequality included white street gangs, white property associations, city police, and when deemed necessary, as during the Chicago race riots of 1919, the Detroit race riots of 1943, and then in the 1960s across northern urban America, the National Guard and the U.S. military. And at the same time, blacks were unwelcome outside big cities in the suburban regions and in the rural hinterland of the North, home to hundreds, if not thousands, of all-white so-called sundown towns, where blacks took their lives in their hands if seen after dark. If you know any older black people from around here, around Chicago area, ask them what it felt like, or what they heard from their parents and grandparents about what it felt like to try to travel outside Chicago, say down to Decatur or Peoria or out to DeKalb or Sycamore or Dixon back in the day. There's a wonderful book about that and how that happened. All from that went in the South, in the Midwest, all the way up to the Upper Midwest, up through Minnesota and the Dakotas, called Sundown Towns by the brilliant historical sociologist James Loewen, the same guy that did the book about lies my history teacher told me. He collected all of his story and data and study he could find about how blacks were pushed out of, I mean completely pushed out of, there's an ethnic cleansing process that took place in places like DeKalb, Illinois, you know, and you know, name your town in Missouri, which to this day is the worst state for racial attitudes in America, between 1880 and 1930. I mean, and I'm glad I read his book a few years ago, because I had never resolved in my mind intellectually, I couldn't figure out why the black migration from the North to the South was so incredibly urban. Lots of black people after Reconstruction would have liked to have become freehold farmers. If you go to rural Iowa, it's dotted with century farms and 120-year-old farms with Eastern European names, just people from peasant backgrounds who are quite comfortable, you know, raising corn and soybeans and potatoes and whatever. And so would many would have. A lot of the black immigrants out of the South, they hated cotton, never wanted to work on that again, but would have been quite at home working in the American family farm revolution that took place in the 19th century. But you don't see it. And that's because of this whole sundown process. That was a bit of a digression. I'm sorry. During the Vietnam War, American Empire found a grisly use for young black male lives in the jungles of Southeast Asia. Blacks were very disproportionately placed in the most vulnerable frontline, killing and dying positions there. During Vietnam, it's actually pretty much only, it's kind of on the left, it's kind of an urban legend all the time that you think all the people doing all the killing, you hear that a lot. You know, all the dangerous jobs are done by blacks. Actually, if you look at the regular list of, and you know, the on the news and they show the pictures, you know, of who's died in the Iraq War, I mean, you see a lot of rural white and a lot of Latino people. It's not just like disproportionately black, but during Vietnam was a particular period, there really was a policy of putting very disproportionate numbers of impoverished blacks in some of the most dangerous frontline killing and dying positions. Now, you know, that's some historical background. Today, as across this long neoliberal era that began in the 70s, black working class and lower class lives, I think, still matter to the profit system, the American capitalist system, primarily a subject for exploitation, and the exploitation still relies heavily on violence and repression, violence that all too commonly turns lethal. But there's a difference now. Black lives have, particularly poor and working class black lives, have been largely torn asunder, along, of course, with millions of white, Latino, and other U.S. lives, from direct engagement in surplus value generating, profit generating, productive labor. And here again, some history I think is useful. Already, actually, by the late 1950s, black northern workers, industrial workers, experienced significant job losses due to automation and the flight of capital and jobs to whiter and more union-free regions of the country. I mean, the Chicago packing house is a perfect example. The great largely black-employing Chicago packing houses, Armour, Swift's, and Wilson's, were all actually closed. Huge employer for the black working class population on the South Side, and a major employment destination for the great black migration. All those big plants were actually pretty much done in Chicago by the end of the 1950s. There were already very significant cutbacks in the auto industry, particularly for black workers by the end of the 1950s and the early 60s. Deindustrialization hit black ghettos earlier and harder than it hit other predominantly working class communities across the North. And mass black joblessness in what would become known as the Rust Belt was a really big factor behind the remarkable wave of race riots that washed across northern U.S. cities in the long, hot summers of the mid-late 60s. And of course, you know, the eviction of black lives from production only deepened with the finance capital-led dismantlement of American manufacturing and heavy industry that took off and flowered in the 70s and the 80s, carried yet further through the next decade by the so-called free trade, actually investor rights, global corporatist North American free trade agreement, NAFTA. So now we're dealing with a largely post-industrial form of exploitation, concentrated in rotting, deeply immiserated ghettos as members of a lumpen proletarianized underclass. For the last three plus decades, millions of black Americans have been learning that they no longer matter to white authorities, to U.S. capitalism as direct producers working with industrial or agricultural materials. Their new leading role from millions of them is now instead to function themselves as raw material, as themselves the critical ingredient for the nation's giant new globally and historically unmatched criminal injustice system of racially disparate mass surveillance, mass arrest, mass sentencing, mass incarceration, mass parole, mass probation, mass felony marking. And I always, when I use the phrase racially disparate, that's from academic sociology, from the racially disparate mass incarceration system. I said, man, sometimes you guys sure like to be technical about your jargon. Can't you just say racist? Racially disparate mass incarceration, also known as the racist prison state. You know, and beyond the sheer magnitude, you know, which is just completely off the charts. What do we have? We had 2.4 million people behind bars, if you include jails along with prisons. And then how, you know, how we're 6 million people under criminal supervision, if you, or more. Probably goes up to 10 if you include parole, probation, all that. I mean, beyond just sheer magnitude, I mean, which is it's just fascinating, isn't it, that the so-called Land of Liberty is the biggest prison state that's ever been known to world history? How the hell did that happen, right? Beyond sheer magnitude, the most striking thing about our prison state is its racialized nature. I mean, by 2001, blacks were 12% of the U.S. population and more than 40% of its 2 million prisoners. I mean, consider the following comparative incarceration rates. And this is kind of old data. It's probably worse now. This is from the turn of the millennium. Japan, incarceration rate, that's everybody. Everybody in Japan, 40 per 100,000. Sweden, 60 per 100,000. England, 125 per 100,000. South Africa, militantly unequal, neoliberal South Africa, 400. Evil, horrible, czarist Russia, 600, just 675. U.S., 690, just the whole population. Black adult U.S. men, 4,848 per 100,000. More than a tenth of all prisoners on planet Earth is a black U.S., quote-unquote, citizen, maybe an ex-citizen. Well, literally an ex-citizen. There are more black men behind bars than enrolled in colleges and universities in the U.S. By 2007, there were more black Americans under criminal supervision, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War. A shocking one in three black adult male is now branded with the lifelong stigma of a felony record, which is a critical barrier. This is what law professor Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. It's a critical barrier to employment. One of the names applied for a job recently here. I think we have some retirees here, but you, every application has that box there down at the bottom, right? Do you or do you not have a felony record? If you do, would you care to elaborate on that felony record? Critical barrier to employment, to education, to housing, to federal assistance. I mean, I could go all the way down the list. And even in many states, to voting. And even in, I don't know, 15 or so states, to voting for life. Ever. You can, because you have a felony record. It's a southern phenomenon mainly, but I'm actually from like the one northern state that actually has that. Iowa. I believe you are disenfranchised permanently with a felony record. And it just all reflects wild racial disparities in the enforcement of the nation's drug laws. The disparities that among many disparities, but probably more than any other, really mock the notion of a colorblind and post-racial America. I mean, I'm here to tell you, whites use and sell illegal drugs, the main crimes driving U.S. and mass incarceration, every bit as much as blacks and Latinos, even more. We are dropping acid. We are smoking dope. We are shooting heroin. We are doing crystal meth. And yet blacks and Latinos together make up 80% of those sent to prison for drug offenses in the U.S. I'll never forget years ago in the Chicago Tribune, there was an item about how white kids from Wheaton and Naperville, right, affluent, they're going to, you know, Neckwa Valley High School, you know, where it might as well be a private school because of the property taxes, you know, it's like $15,000 per pupil, were coming in and buying heroin in North Lawndale. And the response to the criminal justice system when they were busted was to send letters to their parents and say, we thought you ought to know that Buffy and Jody have been seen in a high drug trafficking area. And then they were getting their driver's license suspended. And then the kids that were selling drugs to them, 16 and 17, were tried under the state sentencing laws, were tried as adults and, you know, began their career of going downstate, you know, and serving, you know, beginning their career as lifelong felons and cycling in and recycling in and out of the state's prison system. You know, going downstate's an interesting phrase, right? I mean, one meaning is that your high school team made it into the high school basketball tournament. For a lot of white middle-class folks, it means a trip down to Urbana-Champaign to check out the University of Illinois campus and, you know, or maybe starting school down there. But going downstate on the west side and south side of Chicago has a whole different meaning. It means Stateville, it means Joliet, it means Big Muddy Prison down in Ina, Illinois. Big Muddy, where if you look at Ina, Illinois, you look it up in the U.S. Census, it's 40% black, and you go to Ina, and it's a sundown town. Well, what's that all about? Because the whole black population is behind bars. You know, and how are you supposed to be ready for reentry, too, and interacting with your community and your family when you're all the way down at the southern? You might as well be in Tennessee, damn near. Your family's up in Chicago. Same thing in New York. They build all these prisons because, I'm going to get into this, they're a growth industry, and they build them all along the Canadian border, right? These guys are, how many times can people from Bed-Stuy actually stay in touch with them? Well, you call them on the phone, but, of course, what are the prison phone rates? Or that's another way of making money, are about like 15 times a normal phone call. And so you have this giant army of black prisoners and so-called ex-offenders cycling back and forth between the nation's worst-off, jobless, high-poverty zip codes, where there wasn't any opportunity in the first place, even before you had a felony record, cycling back before those places, those zip codes, and a sprawling archipelago of high-tech mass confinement holding pens, located mainly in predominantly white and rural parts of the nation. When I say holding pens and warehousing, I sort of mean that. There's a bit of another one of the good example of a kind of an urban legend here on the left that is everybody is in prison is yoked to like some sort of industrial process, like they're all making stuff. It's surprisingly rare. There's some of that going on, but it's much less common than you think. It's really kind of a post-industrialized phenomenon. People are pretty much sitting around. I mean, even a lot of fairly progressive prison reform advocates actually want people to be doing more work behind bars in the sense that they might be ready to work when they got out of prison. I was always amused back when I used to study this issue real closely, how many of these guys they were training to become barbers. And I mean, it was like this whole ex-con thing was to be ready to be a barber. So they're recycling back and forth between these ghetto neighborhoods. And the prison and construction and operation boom fed by the rising market. And, you know, the people in that industry will refer to prisoners as a market. I mean, it's the raw material. this fed by the rising market of permanently marked, constantly recycled black criminals, you know, has been a really significant source of jobs, tax dollars, and associated local economic multipliers for mostly rural prison towns. What are the three big growth industries in rural America over the last 20 years? Casinos, CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, the great big fascistic methane generating hog farms, and prisons. And each inner-city black prisoner represents an economic asset that's been removed from a black urban community, placed elsewhere to represent as much as $30,000 to $40,000 worth of income to the usually distant rural and very predominantly white community in which the prison is located. Of course, there's also the value of constructing the prison in the first place. It can be a really significant transfer of value. A young male worth a few thousand dollars of support to children in local purchases in, let's say, North Lawndale or Grand Boulevard or Inglewood is transferred into a $35,000 a year financial asset to a rural prison community. And not surprisingly, as a result of that, prison hosting communities. And I've lived in rural areas enough and been through them and knocked on doors in them enough to, you know, to tell you stories about, you know, communities, you know, like knocking down, you know, going crazy, competing with each other. Can we please have a prison? Which is a bit of a false thing to want, because actually it doesn't actually work out that well. But anyway, not surprisingly, a lot of prison hosting communities themselves gravely challenged by deindustrializing, farm-destroying global neoliberal capitalism become part of the prison industrial lobby that pushes for tougher drug and other sentencing laws to bring them more and more captive urban black people from distant ghettos, right? These towns that, like I said, show up as 40% black in the U.S. Census, and then when you actually go visit them, and they might as well be Mayberry in their downtown areas. You know, this is a disturbing picture full of unsettling parallels to chattel slavery. Young black men involuntarily removed as economic assets from black communities to distant rural destinations where they are kept under lock and key by predominantly white overseers who rely on those unfree blacks for their basic income. You know, and then consider also the fact that these communities, downstate Illinois, upstate New York, upstate Michigan, that are prison towns, get enhanced proportional voting and districting clout in their state legislatures. And there's another unpleasant historical parallel is with the U.S. Constitution's notorious three-fifths clause, whereby three-fifths of the South's slave population counted towards the congressional representation of the slave states in the South. Those prisoners in Stateville, those prisoners in Ion, Illinois, count to the census count, the tax base, the poverty money, and the proportional representation in the Illinois state legislature of whatever that legislative district is down there. And the Tribune's even had legislators joking about that. I get all this money because of those people, and they sure as hell can't vote me out of office. No, they can't vote at all. It's not just cops, prison guards who find employment in this new correctional leviathan. These are some of the, I just pulled this off of, I was curious about this, and I did a Google search, jobs in criminal justice. Prosecutors, of course, court clerks, public defenders, parole officers, probation officers, prison medical staff, prison administrators, criminal justice instructors, correctional facilities managers, police identification and records officers. Begin your new career at DeVry. Juvenile court counselors, medical examiners, court reporters, judges and magistrates. I want to be one of those. I want to be a judge. Though, bailiffs, that sounds pretty cool, too. Forensic science technicians, a little CSI there, that might be kind of sexy. Correctional treatment specialists, wardens, law librarians, law enforcement instructors, and the list goes on and on. And it's not just the public sector. On top of the millions employed directly in governmental criminal justice occupations, millions work in private sector firms contracting with the mass arrest and incarceration system. Of course, there's the building and equipping and the maintaining of police stations, jails, prisons, courts. running programs for offender counseling and rehabilitation, evaluating parolee drug tests. I've been in the job market lately, and I can't tell you how many drug tests I've taken. I can't fathom how I've passed all of them, but parolee drug tests, countless other collateral criminal justice tasks and services subcontract out to private firms. And with all of that, the prison industrial complex generates vast employment revenues beyond just the employment sector. Now, there's that. You know, and I've seen estimates of 3 to 5 billion employees nationwide in the criminal justice system. The nation's biggest private employer is Walmart, and they're about 1.3. Did I say billion? I meant 3 to 5 million. And Walmart's at 1.3 million. So I'm assuming that the criminal justice system is out employing probably Walmart plus Kmart and Target cumulatively, for what that's worth. Now, this vast new black criminal underclass, Latino underclass, poor white underclass, generates money for mostly non-white others in other ways too. It is charged pretty much always at exorbitant rates for various criminal justice processes and services, including court-ordered treatment programs. In recent months, the ACLU has sued a county in the state of Washington. It sued Jackson, Mississippi. It sued Alexander County in Alabama. Rutherford County, I'm familiar with this jurisdiction, in Tennessee. It sued New Orleans and Biloxi, Mississippi for running what the ACLU calls modern-day debtors' prisons. Basically, the criminal justice system now has become a leading tool for financing city and county government in the tax-starved neoliberal era. And here's a little bit how it works, according to a recent Counterpunch commentary by an interesting citizen journalist named Brian Plant, who writes, "The police target the poor for petty infractions that produce fines. When these fines can't be paid, additional fines are piled on top, and the person is thrown in prison. Private collection agencies hound poor people with increasing mountains of fines, collecting money constantly but rarely closing accounts. Milking the poor for city revenue has allowed local governments to provide massive tax breaks for the business community and the wealthy. These programs," Brian Platt writes, "create yet another way to redistribute money from the working class to the capitalist class." He calls it a form of Robin Hood in reverse. Using the police state that was developed during the drug war, local governments found innovative new ways to tax the poor through the targeted efforts of law enforcement. This is what the U.S. Justice Department found in its report on Ferguson, Missouri, earlier this year. By the way, usually those reports take 2-3 years to turn over, but because of the heat in the streets and the social protests, they turn that over in less than a year. And they found that the criminal justice authorities in Ferguson had basically focused almost completely on the police had been focusing on revenue primarily above all, rather than imagine public safety, and that they were colluding with city officials to make up for budget deficits by squeezing the poor with petty fines and violations. They have explicit emails and explicit communications to that effect. All across the country, fines are being used to generate revenue. 41 states charge people room and board fees for imprisoning them. 43 states charge people for the use of a public defender, which is an abject violation of the intent of the Gideon decision that created the profession of public defenders in this country. I hear about a lot of these fine stories all the time because my son is a public defender in Nashville right now. And he's always regaling me with these insane fees that are tagged on people brought in for the mildest of public infractions. 44 states charge fees for probation. 49 states charge for the use of ankle monitors. I'm not paying for an ankle monitor, sorry. Since 2010, every state with the exception of Alaska and North Dakota has increased fees in order to generate revenue. I mean, it's a jailhouse shakedown as cities are scrambling to generate revenue, and they're doing it off the backs of a permanently poor and permanently peonized, permanently indebted criminal class. I mean, and at the most extreme form, this, you know, twisted fiscal project takes literally the form of high way robbery, with police seizing $3 billion a year, each year, in civil asset forfeitures, often conducted on roadside, on the sides of roads. People have been pulled over, money taken out of there without indictments or even search warrants. There's this anonymous Illinois state deputy who's gone online to explain that all of our, this is just, roadway theft is just commonplace now. He said, all of our hometowns, he says, are sitting on a tax-liberating gold mine. Well, pulling over poor folks, particularly poor Black and Latino folks, and hitting them with fines and ripping them off of whatever money they've got. I've been in a few situations, just coincidentally, where I've been around in malls. This happened to me twice. One of the Cherry Valley Mall outside Rockford, where cops move in on a Black group family. And in the case that I witnessed, it was just an unbelievable case. It ended up with people being thrown through glass plate windows and my wife and I dousing the eyes of a 5-year-old girl because the whole family had been pepper sprayed. And the first thing the woman did as the police swept in on was try to get the $200 they brought to the mall to go shopping with them before the cops took it. I mean, it was clearly the concern. They know they will never see that money again. The traffic stops leading to such thefts are typically made on the flimsiest of pretexts, are inflicted very disproportionately on Blacks and Latinos. I used to work at 45th and Michigan at the Chicago Urban League, right in the historical heart of Black Chicago. And it's the only time in my life when I worked there that I used to get pulled over for seatbelt. And it would just be these dragnets at Chicago and Wabash. And I should have known, the second time I should have known better to not even go down there. And you know what? The Chicago police had all of a sudden just become overwhelmed with a concern for the seatbelt safety of the Black Southsiders in Chicago. And I remember the second time this happened, the cop actually took a look at me. You know, because he couldn't make it out from behind. He could, you know, you just look at a car, you can see you don't have a seatbelt because everyone's got a shoulder seatbelt now. That's why he pulled me over. And he saw I was white, and he actually apologized to me. He said, oh, I'm sorry. We run these down here regularly. And he let me go. But and I looked around me, I saw there were like 10 cars. It was just a dragnet of police. And what were they doing? They were tearing those, they had those cars just all torn upside down. The seatbelt thing was the pretext. You talk to Black people from Chicago, and they'll tell you that's routine. By the way, recently we had the case of Black Chicago and Johnny Melton. Johnny Melton got $32,000 to settle a lawsuit over his mother's death, and it was going to help him start a new life after prison. But the Illinois Department of Corrections got wind of his lawsuit gains, and before he was released, after 15 months in prison on a minor drug conviction, the Illinois Department of Corrections sued Melton and won $20,000 to cover the cost of his incarceration. And when Melton was paroled earlier this year, he was forced to go to a homeless shelter, and then he was taken in by a cousin. He got food stamps. When he died in June, didn't have a dime. His sisters had to scuffle up money to cremate him. And the lawsuit was, as the Tribune reported, was one of a small, I'm quoting them, but growing number of cases that with the prisons department brings each year. A small but growing number of cases the prisons department brings each year against inmates to recoup the costs of their imprisonment. These types of policies and practices they're all part of how the system of neoliberal, racist, mass incarceration, felony marking function pretty much as a self-fulfilling prophecy, a vicious circle. I mean, it's like the U.S. global war on terror. The more you bomb and drone attack, the more you tear up Muslim homelands, the more jihadists you generate, the more blowback you get, and the more pretext you get for more imperial violence, with the biggest winners being who? Well, of course, the military, industrial, and security complex, the high-tech so-called defense and security contractors, the Boeings, the Lockheed Martins, the Raytheons, the Martin Marietta's, and the Northrop Grumman's. By the way, complete aside, I just learned recently that Northrop Grumman has contracted to train Colombian Latin American mercenaries and then send them as proxy soldiers for U.S. ally Saudi Arabia to kill Shiites in Yemen. Well, you know, the more you incarcerate and felony mark young black men, the more you shake them down, the more you steal their property. I mean, that's what this asset forfeiture really is. It's summary appropriation. It's primitive accumulation of capital by hundreds of police departments across the country. The more you steal their property, the more disability you heap on their already dismal job and education price. It's not bad enough that you live in a zip code that, you know, where all the livable wage jobs have disappeared over the last 30 years, and now you've got a felony record, and now you're getting shaked down. You know, you talk to black people from the West and South Side, and they will tell you about all the dirty cops. That's the phrase, dirty cops. And those are the cops that shake you down. They come up and say, "I could run you in unless you give me all the money you got in your wallet." Right now. The more you devastate their already dire local economies, the more they have no choice but to turn to the illegal underground economy. And the more they do that, the more they are certain to be recycled back into the prison industrial complex. It's a vicious, endless, self-reinforcing cycle. And, you know, another phenomenon, too, is there's been sociologists have done studies of this, and the more, you know, you arrest people on drugs, the more gangs have to recruit new people to be runners. And, you know, this whole great neoliberal prison-filling police state lockup and shakedown, to me, really is, it provides the critical context for the endemic killing of black Americans by white cops. I mean, hundreds of black Americans die each year as heavily armed police try to round them up to serve as the raw material for the mass incarceration and felony marking regime, and as subjects for the great racist, neoliberal jailhouse shakedown and highway street corner robbery. And like slavery, and like its Jim Crow successor regime in the U.S. South, and like the pre-mass incarceration urban ghettoized regimes of Chicago and Detroit in the mid-20th century, it's a system that does not shirk from killing its black human profit sources when that kind of lethal violence is deemed necessary. You know, it's telling to me that one of the frequent causes of fatal police shootings is, what else? Flight. Few things do more to provoke a police officer into using lethal force than a potential prisoner trying to run away. I'm sure some of you saw the South Carolina video earlier this year. Basically, the guy knew he had a warrant out on him. He had a taillight violation or something like that. He knew he had a warrant out on him. He knew that was going to cost him a whole bunch of money. He knew he was going to be in trouble with his parole officer. I mean, these folks are locked in with all kinds of outstanding issues of the criminal justice system. I mean, there's a whole culture of how to try and live on the outside when you're out of prison before you're back in it. There's monographs out about that. You know, and he was just running away, and the guy just calmly stepped in. I'm sure some of you saw the video. That, in some ways, was more chilling than the Laquan McDonald video, because the guy was just almost like blasé about it. It was almost like, you know, put his glasses on, aimed his gun, shot, and, you know, then went over and in this blasé kind of way planted a gun next to the guy. I didn't know there was a guy with a cell phone taking a video of the whole thing. Trying to run away. Now, I know this Ronald Johnson video, I don't know how many of you have seen that. I don't know if the guy had a gun or not. And I'm not naive. Sometimes these guys have guns. I'd probably have a gun if I was living in some of these neighborhoods and involved in the underground economy. But what's he doing? He's running away. I mean, do the cops need physical fitness programs so they can? I mean, I watch all the TV shows. There are all these great heroic chases, and you're running over fences, and then you collar the guy, and it's like a cornerback, you know, getting a wide receiver before he can get into the end zone. No, shoot him. I mean, it wasn't more than 20 feet, was it, in the Ronald Johnson case? Come on, get some exercise. I mean, and people getting shot in the back. So, you know, it's trying to run away, running from a contemporary prisoner catcher, a badge brandishing peace officer trained to shoot to kill. We had a case in Iowa City a year back, and I said, well, why did John Dang have to be shot, like, right through the heart?
Well, that's how we're trained, by God, with the full body mass shot. We don't take any cheap-ass shots in the leg or anything like that. Shoot to kill. Running away from contemporary prisoner catcher, a badge brandishing peace officer trained to shoot to kill, gets young, poor, black, and poor white, and Latino men killed with chilling regularity in the land of freedom today. And, you know, if he'd lived into the current neoliberal era of mass incarceration, an era that arose on the ashes of his effort to build a great poor people's movement to end poverty in America, I think the mass incarceration era arose, among other things, in part as payback for that great rebellion of the 1960s. But if he'd lived into this era, Dr. King would certainly put the mass imprisonment regime and the brave new militarized police state that feeds that regime at the heart of his understanding of how America has thingified black lives and how America has betrayed its promises of freedom and democracy and opportunity. He would put the end of the drug war, I'm quite certain, and the dismantlement of the police and the prison state at the heart of his calls for the radical reconstruction of his society itself. He would put these demands front and center in his case for America to be born again, as King liked to say, we should call for it at the end of his life. So, you know, whatever happens with Tiny Dancer, coming days and months, and I do hope and pray that he can be forced out, and I must say, listening to some of the language, even of elite media authorities and Chicago Tribune editorial board, I'm starting to think that might be a possibility. Whatever happens with Tiny Dancer coming days and months, let's also remember that the roots of modern evil are ultimately in the system, and it is the system itself that we must uproot, that we must transform on this and so many other fronts. And on that, thank you very much, and let's talk. Because I just scratched the surface.